From KU, we are news in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Florence Williams' book about breasts explores the subject from different angles. She looks at our cultural perceptions of the breast. She works through the theories about why humans have breasts. She writes about how the breast is changing, getting bigger and arriving earlier, and how it's attracting the chemicals of the modern world. It's that part, the chemicals part, that Williams really focuses on. She says breasts carry the burden of the mistakes that we've made in our stewardship of the planet. So, at its heart, her book is an environmental history of a body part. The story of how women's breasts went from being shaped by the environment to being harmed by it. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation with Florence Williams. She joined us to talk about what she calls a natural and unnatural history of breasts. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Science writer Florence Williams is our guest today. She's written what she calls a natural and unnatural history of breasts. Williams calls the breast an evolutionary masterpiece, and she says they're still changing. They're getting bigger, they're arriving earlier, but most importantly, they seem to be absorbing more and more of the chemicals and toxins of a modern era. Scientifically, medically, culturally, Williams says in the book, we've seen breasts as disembodied objects removed from the rest of the human body and separate from the rest of nature. She calls her book really just an environmental history of a body part. Florence Williams is a contributing editor at Outside Magazine. She's written for The New York Times and Slate, among many others. Florence Williams, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So I want to start with how you started thinking about all of this, because you say in the book that you really didn't think a lot about breasts until you became a mother.
It's true. My breasts were not a big part of my thought process. Yeah. They were sort of normal, average, everyday breasts. And really, I guess I came to have a new appreciation and understanding of them when I was breastfeeding.
Yeah.
That's when I first became kind of wowed, you know, by what miracles they are. It's, for many women, I think it's the first time that we really feel like a mammal in a way. And it's actually very profound to be able to really feed and nourish, you know, another human being.
Yeah.
It's amazing. But then I also, as a science journalist, I saw science reports that certain industrial chemicals were appearing in breast milk. And I was nursing my daughter at the time. I was concerned about this.
Yeah.
And I thought it would be an interesting story to tell as a journalist with a first-person voice. So I had my own breast milk tested, and that's really what sent me down this path of learning more about what's going on with the modern world and our breasts.
So you talk about in the book how your first experience breastfeeding, that it didn't work out so well. It was kind of hard to get it to work, and then you learn to love the experience. And this, as you say, I guess this was your second child, your daughter, is when you were, as you mentioned, you were reading an article about it. But it really seemed to have a profound effect on you. It really worried you reading the article. And I guess something dawned on you that you hadn't thought about before, I guess. Is that right?
Well, that's true. I think as breastfeeding mothers, you know, many of us are so aware of how healthy we are. We're so aware of trying to, you know, govern what goes into our bodies, you know, when we're pregnant also. I mean, we were supposed to stop smoking. We're supposed to stop drinking. We're supposed to eat certain kinds of food and avoid certain kinds of exposures, you know. And I exercised a lot. I lived in a really leafy, beautiful town in the Rocky Mountains. I had this self-concept of being, you know, very healthy. And so when I found out, when these lab results came back, and I found out that, in fact, I had slightly higher than average levels for some substances such as flame retardants in my breast milk, it shocked me. And it also gave me this new understanding, really, of how our bodies are sort of permeable. Mm. And our environment and our bodies interact with one another, you know, in a way that I think we're not really, you know, thought to think about very much.
Yeah. So did you always intend then for this to be kind of an environmental history? Because there's more to it than that, of course, and we'll get work through the sort of evolutionary aspects. But that was the thing that got you started, I guess.
It really was. My primary intent in writing the book was to look at this body part through an environmental lens.
Yeah.
As a journalist, I had been writing about environmental issues for a long time, but they were sort of detached you know, from people. Mm-hmm. I would write about, you know, clean air policy or Forest Service regulations. You know, and I think after a while, that was kind of boring even me. Mm-hmm. And I became, especially when I was became a parent, I became really much more interested in the relationship between the environment and our health.
Well, you write about that there was this connection you found. I mean, your breasts connected you to your children, but they also connected you to a bigger ecosystem as well.
That's right. I came to think of breasts as being really an ecological organ.
Yeah.
You know, they're so responsive to the rest of our bodies and the cues within our bodies, but they're also really responsive to the world around us. And that's really the way they were designed to be.
Yeah. Talk about what you wanted for the book. I mean, in part, you say this, you say in the book, you want to restore breasts to their former glory. Mention that, but also, I mean, a lot of this is also about how women can safeguard their breasts. I mean, that's an important intent, it seems, at least for what you're trying to get at in the book as well.
Well, I think as we become more aware of how our actions, you know, on the planet sort of affect things that we don't necessarily think about so much, such as our health, I think as we become more aware of that, we develop more of a responsibility, I think, and a sense of responsibility for how to protect ourselves. But I also learned through writing this book that there's only so much an individual can do.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can talk more about that. But I certainly learned that we are surrounded by hormone-acting chemicals in our world every day. And we can have some control over that, but not as much as we'd probably like.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned this experience where you tried to detox. You and your daughter went through this experience of having your blood tested, I guess it was.
They were urine tests.
Yeah. And you went through this process, and we'll get into the particulars as we go, but of trying to sort of see if you could detox your way out of it. And in some ways, you couldn't. Really?
That's right. You know, as part of the book, I kind of continued this first-person line of inquiry using my body in some ways as a laboratory. And so for the first part of this experiment, I lived like a normal American.
Yeah.
And, you know, I used personal care products like shampoos and toothpaste that I bought in the supermarket, like most of us do. I ate a little bit of canned food. I think the average American eats about one canned food meal every 5 days. You know, I had a soda or two, used some nail polish. You know, it was nothing extreme. It was really the normal American life for a few days.
Yeah.
Tested my urine and my daughter's for a number of hormone-mimicking compounds. And then a couple weeks later, I went detox. So I stopped using these personal care products. I tried to eat food that hadn't touched plastic. And
how hard was that, by the way?
It was almost impossible.
Yeah.
It was almost impossible. I almost felt like maybe I should go buy a dairy cow and put it in my backyard.
Right.
Because everything you buy in the supermarket comes in plastic,
pretty much. Yeah.
And I did lose some weight because it was so hard to eat. So that was a side benefit. But it was really – it was an interesting experiment because for some of the substances, for example, let's see, BPA, which is sort of known as the baby bottle chemical, that's an additive added to plastic to make it harder. It's also in the lining of canned soda and canned food, as well as in a number of other polycarbonate plastics in our lives. I was able to bring my levels down, I think about 66 or 70% for that. But even there, I couldn't bring it down all the way.
Yeah.
And what that told me was that I really don't know where my exposures are coming from. When we buy products in the supermarket, there's no ingredients labeled for most of these chemicals. They're not required to be advertised or labeled, and so they're not.
Mm. In the book, you mentioned the incredibly numerous amounts and ridiculous names that we come up with for breasts over time. You write that we love breasts, yet we can't quite take them seriously. Talk about that, sort of our cultural impressions about all of this and how difficult it might have been, I guess, to study the breast or to talk about it or to do interviews about it. I mean, are we squeamish about the breast?
Boy, we really are. It's so interesting. We have a very narrow view of the breast, and of course, it's in some ways it gets a lot of attention.
Yeah.
People obsess over breasts. We all love breasts. Men love to look at them. This has been repeatedly shown in study after study that their pupils will look to the breast region within 200 milliseconds, of looking at a woman's body. It's really kind of amazing. And I think it was Dave Barry, the humorist, who joked that breasts evolved to make men stupid.
Yeah.
And so I noticed, a lot of our words for breasts are synonyms for stupid, such as nummies or boobs or ninnies. We have these sort of affectionate terms, but they're also, there's a tinge of insult there. We really don't take them very seriously. And so I was surprised to learn that in the book, that our knowledge of breasts is really pretty limited.
Why do you think it is that we don't? I mean, we'll talk about, I want to get to the sort of remarkable lack of insight we have on the biology of the breast, for example. But why? Is this a cultural thing? Do you think you figured that out, why we don't know?
It does seem to be a cultural thing.
Yeah.
Because certainly when you look across different cultures and across different times, I think the United States today is uniquely obsessed with the breast. It's kind of a historical anomaly. Certainly in our evolutionary past, breasts were considered very functional objects, and it was not unusual for them to be just hanging out all over the place. Children grew up watching their aunties breastfeed. Even sometimes unrelated relatives would breastfeed an infant, if it was crying. Breasts were just these utilitarian objects. And I mean, I'm sure they've always been also sources of pleasure. And, there's so many nerves going through them. They're very sensitive. They're wonderful, wonderful body parts. But I think our particular obsession with them is unique to this time and place.
Hmm. You also say that there has never been a greater, at least in modern life, urge to understand them. The urge to understand breasts has never been greater, you say. Why do you figure that? Are you just people like you are just sort of discovering the connections here?
Well, certainly many people have been researching breast cancer for a long time. So I think from a cancer perspective, the breast has gotten some attention. Although I was astounded to find out, for example, that lactation is not taught in many medical schools. Many doctors don't know very much about lactation. And certainly in the middle of the last century, in the 1950s and 60s, they were much happier to, for example, prescribe or suggest formula than they were to sort of figure out, whether the baby was really getting enough to eat with breast milk. I think there was this discomfort that lactation was this realm of midwives and grandmothers, and it wasn't sort of scientific. And, we really embraced science in all aspects of motherhood, in the middle of the last century. And so lactation really fell victim to that. Mm. And breastfeeding rates declined enormously. I think only 20-25% of infants were breastfed in around the 1960s when I was born. And I know certainly a lot of people in my generation, including me, were mostly raised on formula.
So let's talk about the biology. It's interesting we don't really know much about the basic biology of the breast.
Yeah, that's apparently true. For example, there are so many milk ducts in each breast in the mammary gland, but we don't know how many. We're still figuring out the basic biology. We don't even really know very much about where cancer starts. We think it starts in the milk-making lobules. But we're not sure about that. There have been various theories about it. There may be as many as 20 or 25 different types of breast cancer. So we're starting to gain some new understanding of that. We don't know what causes breast cancer. We have an idea of some of the risk factors, but even those don't explain much of the prevalence that we see today.
The development of the breast you write about, I guess we have some sense that they do most of their developing after birth. You say, and it kind of has to, you put it this way in the book, it has to sort of build itself out of nothing during puberty.
The breast is really unique in the human body in that it does almost all of its growing up in adulthood and well after birth. For example, the breast doesn't really fully develop until the last trimester of pregnancy. So for some women, you know, that happens many decades into their lives or not at all. And that's one of the theories about why breasts may be so vulnerable to carcinogens. They haven't really differentiated, unlike many organs in our body.
So the other thing that's interesting is you talk about this, the development is a kind of a process of the cells are kind of communicating with each other. There's this kind of matrix of communication going on in the breast.
Yes, and that happens, you know, early in puberty, the breast is filled with estrogen and progesterone receptors, and those receptors pick up environmental cues and cues within our body for when to start growing, and the mammary gland will start growing. And then the breast can also sense when the body is pregnant, when there's a baby, you know, cooking one story down, then all of a sudden this dairy machinery will kick in and will literally build itself, you know, almost from scratch. And then this is amazing. After breastfeeding, the breast regresses and it loses 80% of that mammary gland that it just built. So it almost totally goes away, and then it will rebuild again in the next pregnancy. So it's this incredibly dynamic process. I say it's almost like Caesar making camp and breaking camp every time there's a pregnancy. Hmm. And even a little bit of that process happens in every menstrual cycle. There's a little bit made and a little bit taken away. It's really dynamic.
You write about a cell biologist at the University of California in San Francisco, Zena Werb, is it?
Yes.
And you talk about seeing some of the images in her lab as you're trying to explore the biology of this. And you say in some ways they kind of were too abstract for you to kind of wrap your mind around it in some way. Talk about that. You say they were a little too abstract for you. And then you write about how in order – some of the best work on breast anatomy, you say, is like 170 years old.
It's true. There is this great guy named Astley Cooper, yeah. And he was a surgeon in England in the 1820s, 30s, and 40s. I think he was actually the head surgeon to a king at that time. He was very interested in breasts, and the way he used to study them was he would participate in the cadaver trade. And, which is how, you know, many surgeons and doctors learn their trade.
Yeah.
So he would get a hold of breasts from people who had died of all ages, including men. He studied the male mammary gland, which actually exists as well. And he filled the ducts with wax, and he really learned more about how the ducts work than anyone has almost, you know, before or since. And then he published a book with sort of these amazing pictures of the mammary glands. I think they almost look like, you know, spaghetti in a way. It's kind of gross, but to him they were really these beautiful, fascinating objects of study.
And then I guess people figured that, okay, Sir Astley Cooper did the definitive work and no one really talked about it for like a century.
Well, you know, one of the I guess more popular ways of studying mammary glands was in dairy animals, because there was a lot of money in dairy cows and in the dairy industry. So we know more about mammary glands from the dairy industry really than we do from the medical industry.
You described the function a smartphone and a juice bar in one. I guess it's just a remarkably sensitive, I guess still mysterious, right?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I think what really brought that home to me was learning more about lactation.
Yeah.
Because when a mother is nursing her infant, the breast is responsible for so much. You know, not only is breast milk nutritional, but it turns out we're learning more and more that it's really a medicine,
yeah.
That it even evolved for that purpose, to fight disease and to help colonize the infant gut, you know, with this beneficial balance of bacteria that now we understand is so important to future health. And so the breast has to know all these things about the infant while it's breastfeeding. For example, breast milk is different in the first weeks of lactation than it is from the first year of lactation. 12 months later, the milk is very different in composition to meet the changing needs of that growing infant. And if an infant is sick, the breast milk will sometimes put more antibacterial properties in the breast milk. So there's this crosstalk going back and forth between the infant and the breast responds accordingly.
And responds also like if the infant is a preemie.
Well, the breast milk of a mother who's had a premature infant is also different in composition from a full-term infant. We don't really know if that's because somehow the breast knows it's a preemie or if the breast gland itself is not fully developed because the pregnancy was interrupted. So we don't really know why the breast milk is different, but it turns out that it is better suited to the needs of a preemie. And it's just an amazing – it's an amazingly responsive milk production factory. And of course, formula, you know, it's sort of one size fits all. It doesn't do the crosstalk.
I guess the thing is, just in terms of the biology, it's the intimate kind of connection, the way it's relating to the body and the environment, which we'll get to. But that part, it's that communication factor. And then the other thing you also talk about, which is really interesting, and we can get more into this when we talk about the evolution, but the way breastfeeding helped us evolve as a species and develop these communication and these kind of and emotion and gestures like kissing. In some ways, we're related back to that.
Yeah, I learned that breasts are actually responsible for the way we kiss because our lips and our palate, it makes sense. Our mouths had to co-evolve with the shape of the human breast and the human nipple. And so thanks to breasts, we have these great palates that also enable us to speak. We think of, well, of course, breasts, you know, mammary glands, breast milk, that's why we're alive. But really, the connections go even deeper into, you know, our facial structure and our mouth structure. And then the act of breastfeeding itself, and not just for humans, but lactation itself provides this opportunity for mammals to spend a lot of time together. And so for there to be this transcription of knowledge between the mother and the offspring, our brains were able to get bigger in response to this. We were able to learn more about social behavior as mammals, and all mammals do this, because we have to spend so much time with the mother during lactation.
Florence Williams is with us. She's the author of the book Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the science journalist Florence Williams. We're talking about her book, Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History. So one of the things you write about in the book is that, you know, breasts are kind of the defining trait of humanity. It was Carl Linnaeus, that Swedish botanist, who really named all mammals after this one feature, right? But it was interesting, his perspective on it all, which is going to sort of lead us into the way men have been thinking about all of this for a long time. I mean, he thought a woman's rightful place was in the home.
That's right. Linnaeus really developed taxonomy and classification. And he could have named mammals after a number of our shared traits. For example, our inner ear construction wouldn't have been nearly as fun. But he decided to name us mammals, commemorating and emphasizing the mammary gland in that classification name. But it's interesting, as one scholar pointed out, he also had a political agenda in doing so, because this was during the Enlightenment in Europe, and women were gaining a little bit more influence in the political realm. And this is something that Linnaeus was deeply opposed to. He believed that mothers should be home. And so, you know, in naming us mammals and in emphasizing that this was our sort of shared destiny, he really may have been, trying to emphasize that that's where he thought women should be and what they should be doing most of their time.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think this is an important point you talk about, that you say that for decades, male scientists had really been kind of getting the breast wrong. I mean, there was this impression that, and there's still this impression exists, I'm sure, that the breast was, you know, it was more for, it evolved to meet the needs of the male. It was kind of a sexual adornment rather than something more functional, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's important to point out that mammary gland and breast are sort of two different things. Yeah. And, you know, all mammals have mammary glands, but the breast in humans is really unique because it's this kind of, you know, fatty, rounded, pendulous, fleshy tissue. And we get it in puberty and we keep it really through our entire adult lives. And that's very unusual. Even among primates, they only have these kinds of swellings on their chest while they're lactating. Yeah. So the real question is, well, why? If we don't need these just for the mammary gland, why do we have these kind of, beautiful, soft, squishy orbs on our chest? And so for many decades, the dominant theory, and it's still really the dominant theory, is that breasts evolved as sexual signals.
Yeah.
And that they must exist to tell men something. For example, about the fertility status or the health or the youth of a woman. And that so that these breasts are really for men. Desmond Morris was a famous anthropologist. He wrote a book called The Naked Ape in the 1960s. And part of his thinking was that humans walk upright as opposed to other primates. And so they needed something really sexy on their frontal side in order to sort of keep male interest so that men could, you know, the early cavemen could bring home the mastodon and have something to keep their interest at home. And of course, this is in the 1960s. and that view of human evolution really does remind me of sort of that dead zone suburb of the mid 20th century. And then these more women came up in the field of anthropology. And they really burst a lot of bubbles on a number of fronts. And one of them was that they pointed out, actually, that many women throughout our early evolution procured their own calories. Thank you very much. And they didn't really depend on the caveman to bring home the mastodon every day. So that was the first problem. And then they said, you know, we understand that a lot of men like breasts. However, that interest may have come later, or it may not be why breasts evolved. Maybe we should actually look at what breasts are made out of. Maybe we should look at how they work and sort of rethink this. And so that's what they did.
Because – so you, what you're saying is that because we were seeing them as this sort of sexual signal, that we weren't thinking about their health or the way they functioned.
Yeah, exactly. Once again, they were this kind of disembodied object.
Yeah.
They were these creatures on the chest of a woman that had a life of their own, you know, that served men. Really, that was the theory. That's still what a lot of people are taught. I know in colleges, people tell me that's why breasts exist. But the other theories talk about, well, maybe there's something about this extra fat depot that really helped women survive and that then served her infant.
Yeah. You say in the book there are a lot of pretty entertaining and pretty far-fetched breast origin stories.
There are. One of my favorites, this was posited by an Israeli researcher, and he thinks that women have to have big breasts in order to counterbalance their big rear ends. And I have my sister-in-law jokes that is the reason in her case.
But you're not buying it. Right?
No, I don't buy it. I guess what this debate really brings home for me is that it is very hard to know the answers to some of these questions about our deep evolutionary past.
Yeah.
We don't even know when breasts evolved in early hominids because they don't leave fossil evidence. You know, we go dig up a fossil like Lucy or Ardipithecus, and we don't know her cup size. You know, we have no idea if she had breasts. And yet, anthropologists love breasts so much that whenever they draw pictures of what these early humans might have looked like, they always draw them with breasts. And Mrs. Bigfoot is always drawn with breasts. And these are totally ahistorical renderings, but we just love breasts so much that we just put them wherever we can.
It's interesting. I mean, you talk about how the question is, this wasn't men selecting breasts, but breasts selecting men. But it's still controversial, right? I mean, it's still the so-called women-centered theories are they gaining traction? I mean, what are you seeing there, I guess?
I think they're probably gaining a little traction. What I like about the women's theories is at least they point up the biases, in these more sort of old school theories. And what it really points out is that we all have our biases, and anthropologists, I think, fall prey to this, especially because they are projecting back into time. And it's very hard not to project your current cultural biases back into time. So, you know, when breasts are so important to our sort of Western culture now, it's hard to imagine that they might not have been, you know, in the same way 10,000 or 50,000 years ago. But I think the debate is really important, because it does color how we see breasts. And if we accept the dominant evolution theory that breasts are really purely sexual objects, it justifies our over-sexualizing them in our current culture. And that, in turn, makes it that much harder to convince women, for example, to breastfeed, which is hard to do. We already have a lot of cultural challenges encouraging women to breastfeed. And I think a big part of that is that breasts are considered as these sexual, you know, sexual creations.
So the sense that they were, to the degree that they might be sexual, you think that's a cultural sort of behavior?
Sure it's a cultural behavior. But it also may be partly an evolutionary behavior.
Sure.
And I think, you know, it's hard to know really whether all men across all time, you know, thought of breasts sexually. We just really don't know. But even if they do, it still doesn't necessarily justify that's why we have them. That interest could have come later.
It's interesting how, and we talked a little bit about this, how crucial breasts seem to have been in the evolution of our species and how successful we've been. You mentioned, you know, they sort of helped us get the upper hand on the dinosaurs. That's how we became...
Lactation.
Yeah.
Yes. I had a good time talking to one of the world's foremost experts in mammalian lactation. He actually specializes in seal lactation, and he's tasted seal breast milk. He says it's very fishy. But he has this beef with biologists, which is that lactation gets kind of underappreciated as this amazing innovation, you know, in the development of mammals that helped us be so flexible so that we could sort of inherit the earth really after the dinosaurs. We didn't have to live near a food source for our infants. For example, baby crocodiles, the babies have to hang out, you know, by the side of the stream and wait for the baby fish that they can digest. But mammals can go wherever mom goes.
Yeah.
They always have a ready food source because mom is right next door. And that, I guess, enabled us to really move into niches that we hadn't moved into before. Mammals exploded in numbers after the fall of dinosaurs, and lactation really enabled that to happen.
I want to ask about you went to Houston, sort of the epicenter of the boob job, I think is how you put it in the book. And you went to the offices of a Dr. Michael, is it Saravino?
Caravino.
Caravino. Talk about that experience, if you would, because you had him examine you and you got a sense of, I guess this is another sense of, I guess culturally, how we look at the breast.
Boob jobs, breast implants, are more popular now than ever. Over 300,000 American women get them a year. They spend a lot of money on them. And I wanted to learn more about what this was about. And it turns out that Houston really is kind of ground zero for boob jobs. And so I went to visit the surgeon who performs more breast augmentations than anyone else in Texas. I think he does something like 800 a year.
Wow.
And it was really quite an impressive experience. because it's the whole thing is so seductive, and his office was really beautiful. It was white marble. You feel like you're walking into a beautiful store where you can buy a product, and that product is a new pair of breasts. And it struck me that, you know, that the cell is so it's so powerful and so seductive that it really does not convey at all the sense that you're walking into a major medical surgery. And in fact, someone at that office told me that breast implants are 100% safe. And that's just not true. You know, I was able to do some research. There are a lot of studies about implants now. And while they're much, much safer than they used to be, they're nowhere near 100% safe.
So what do you make of women who feel like they need a breast augmentation surgery? I mean, you know, some say, look, it just helps their health, self-esteem. You know, I mean, you hear all kinds of reasons. I mean, what are you making of the conversation that you hear?
Well, you do. When you talk to women who have implants or who want them, they do. They say these have really made them happy. They make them feel better about themselves, improve their self-esteem. You know, I can't argue with that.
Yeah.
I think for some women, that's absolutely true. They say they're not doing it for the men in their lives. They're doing it for themselves. But I also think that while I don't want to judge these women, I mean, I do understand their decisions. I think we also need to look at the broader context in which these decisions are made and understand that we do live in a culture where there's tremendous pressure on women to look a certain way. You know, women have made so many gains in the last 40 years in the workplace. But if anything, there's more pressure on them to be youthful looking and beautiful looking than ever before. And certainly thanks to technologies like the internet, we are surrounded by images of that have been photoshopped or that aren't real of you know, beautiful breasts. It's very, very tough to compete with that. And I think young people growing up today, I feel sorry for them in a way because they really have much more pressure on them than we did growing up, because I think we saw more real bodies and they see more fake ones.
I mean, and this was sort of an academic exercise in some ways for you. You were actually examined by Dr. Caravita.
I was, yeah. I wanted to walk through the process.
Yeah, and so we talk about that because I don't know if you could say he was talking you into it, but there did seem to be a bit of pressure there. You did sort of... and you did go into this Vectra imaging machine, which you need to talk about if you would, too. I mean, it all seems really interesting.
It was really interesting. I probably need to preface this by saying I have, you know, probably B, size B cups. You know, they're sort of, like I said, very average, normal breasts. But now, thanks to this wonderful technology, you can walk into a plastic surgeon's suite and you can actually see what you would look like with bigger breasts. And so that's what we did. I took off my robe. I had to disrobe in the name of journalism. I went into this sort of contraption that takes a 3D picture of my torso, and then the picture gets manipulated, so I could see what I would look like, you know, with a C cup or a D cup. And it's funny, in my particular case, it really didn't work out very well. The image got sort of distorted, and I ended up with these really strange-looking sideways breasts going on. It was really funny. And the doctor came in, and he said, oh, whoa, 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 that's whoa. Yeah. That's just the machine. You're not really going to look like that. So actually, I was not too tempted. But I can see how if you walk in there and you get a great image, you might be like, wow, va, va, voom, that's what I want.
But wasn't the like the first thing he said to you was that you're a really good candidate for this?
Yeah, I that surprised me too. I've always, you know, been happy enough with my breasts, and the doctor he measured my breasts and he took out a measuring tape and he sort of squeezed them and squished them, and then he stepped back and he made this pronouncement and he said, well, actually, you would be a great candidate for breast augmentation surgery. And what it said to me was that this industry is so good at convincing us that what we have isn't really good enough.
You write about sort of the history of boob jobs, I guess if we put it that way. The first breast augmentation surgery happened, I think, 1895. Was that right?
There was an attempt in 1895 to transplant fat from a woman's backside into her breasts. And she was actually a stage singer. So there you go. From the very beginning, it was women who were kind of visible and in show business who really set the trend here.
Didn't go well.
It didn't go well. The fat kind of disintegrated and got lumpy. Didn't really work out so well. And so after that, there were many other kind of strange and sometimes sordid attempts to transplant different foreign objects into breast tissue. For example, glass balls and ox cartilage.
Wood chips,
ribbons.
Ribbons?
Yeah, I heard ribbons.
Honey, too, you say?
Honey, paraffin wax. The paraffin wax was also a problem because it melted in the sun.
Wow.
And it also got lumpy. You know, it's just this long, sorry history, really. A lot of these women had problems with infections, problems with gangrene, breasts turning blue and green. And then later, you know, once we got higher tech materials after World War II, there was an attempt to use Teflon and polyester and even kitchen sponges. Those turned hard very quickly, unfortunately.
Yeah. Talk about Thomas, I think it was Thomas Cronin. Also, this is Houston, 1959. And he has this kind of eureka moment, which brings us to the silicone transplant.
Right. There are two surgeons, Thomas Cronin and Frank Giroux, are really credited with the first silicone boob job. It all started after World War II, again, when silicone was invented for use by the military in World War II. And after the war, Dow Corning was looking for new uses for their great silicone. And one of their uses was they replaced glass blood bags with silicone blood bags. Yeah. And this was a great innovation because the glass was breaking all over the place. It wasn't so handy. And one of these surgeons, I think it was Frank Giroux or Thomas Cronin, was holding one of these new warm bags of blood. And this is an apocryphal story. He said to himself, "My, that feels good. That feels like a breast." And there you go. That was the beginning of the boob implant industry as we know it. Pretty soon, those silicone bags were filled with silicone gel. And the first one was implanted into a dog named Esmeralda. Mm. She did not really like her new boob job, and she ended up chewing the implants out. And then after that, they were looking for a human guinea pig.
Yeah, and they found one with Timmy Jean Lindsay.
They found one, a woman named Timmy Jean Lindsay, 1962. She actually had some tattoos on her chest that she wanted removed. And so she walked into a public hospital in Houston. And I guess depending on your perspective, she either walked into the right room or the wrong room.
Yeah.
Because she walked into the room of these surgeons. And they said, "We notice your breasts are sagging. Perhaps you would like to have implants." And her experience was sort of like mine. She said, "Well, I never knew I had a problem. I never thought about that. What I really want is to get my ears pinned back." And so the doctor said, "Well, I'll make you a deal. How about we pin back your ears and in exchange you get the implants?" And so she did. And believe it or not, she's still alive.
Yeah, almost 80 now, isn't she?
Yeah, she's 80. And I talked to her. She still has the original 50-year-old implants in her chest.
How does she talk about it? She doesn't want to get them removed for some reason.
She doesn't. She knows that one of them has ruptured. They've hardened and they've caused her some pain. But overall, I think she's actually kind of proud to have been part of this, important history in the Houston plastic surgery history. She's kind of proud of it. And she's also afraid, frankly, of getting another surgery to have them removed, because once they've been in there for 50 years, it's actually rather complicated procedure to try to get them out. She says that science can have them if they want them.
When she's through with them.
When she's through with them.
Florence Williams is with us. Her book is called Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. We'll be right back. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the science journalist Florence Williams. We're talking about her book, Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History. Well, I want to get to the environmental part of the story, which is a big, big part of this, of course. You talk about in the book that our bodies really, you put it this way, our bodies aren't temples. They're more like trees. So I guess one of the important things you learned was just how complex human health really is in all of this.
That's right. And I think for a lot of us, that's kind of a revelation that our bodies are so permeable and that they're in constant conversation with the world around us. You know, we've now come out of kind of the big germ theory era where we thought if we just take a pill and kill a germ that we can be healthy. And part of that had to do with the fact that our bodies, only get sick if something invades the body. But really, the water that we drink, the food that we eat, the air that we breathe, there's this constant inflow and outflow of materials, in and out of our cells. And many of the things that are in our world actually have they act on our cells and they have biological relevance. For example, there are substances that mimic hormones in our world. And we know that these have the capacity to change the way the hormone receptor behaves. And that sets off a whole cascade of biological changes. And so for me, it was really it was profound to just know how connected we are, in ways that we haven't been told. I think we also have been told for so long that DNA was our destiny.
Yeah.
And if we could just figure out what our genes were, encoded in there were sort of the secrets to our future. And now we know actually that's not the case, that the environment can change our gene expression and may be just as important as the genes themselves. And so that's known as epigenetics. So we have the genes that are within our cells, but we also, our genes are meant to be responsive because we haven't, we've needed that flexibility in our evolutionary past and we've needed a little bit of ability to switch course. And so that's why epigenetics now is becoming a much bigger deal.
You talk about how in some ways you're hoping that this conversation leads us back to these sort of ancient ideas about how we related to the environment. I guess a more sort of natural expression of all of that.
I think that's right. Before germ theory, people were really more superstitious, certainly, about how the environment affected their bodies. They used to think there were swamp vapors, that could make them sick, for example, or mysterious spirits that could get into your body. So those weren't necessarily accurate either. Yeah. But there was this more holistic understanding that our health was connected to our sort of geography and a place and time. And I think we are starting to come back around to those kinds of realizations that that our health is really connected to the world around us.
What are you learning about breast cancer? What is this? What kind of insights is this giving us, do you think, about breast cancer? Because, you talk about, when you see the rise of the incidence in breast cancer, and a lot of that is influenced, as you point out in the book, about, by these – we have better ways now of diagnosing it. But you say that doesn't explain it all.
Yeah. I guess I had always heard that in some ways we could blame ourselves or our genes for breast cancer, that, if you have a family history, that would explain a lot.
Or all these lifestyle factors.
If you smoke, if you are obese, if you take hormone replacement therapy and menopause, you're really setting yourself up. If you're not exercising, look out. But it turns out that all of those risk factors are actually quite small, with the exception of family history. Family history is still important.
Sure.
But a lot of those lifestyle factors that we can influence, it turns out, they're actually not that big a deal. And that's both good and bad. I think it lets some of us off the hook, if we did, eat a little too much at last Christmas meal. On the other hand, it also makes you feel like there's not that much you can do. A lot of breast cancer activists are really calling for more research into the prevention of breast cancer. Rather, we've spent so many resources, so much money on detecting breast cancer. There's so much emphasis on the need to get mammograms. And now, unfortunately, we're learning that even mammography is not very accurate, especially for women under 50 who still make up a sizable percentage of women who get breast cancer. And so now women are saying, you know what? Let's do some more research into chemicals. Let's do some more research into foods. Let's can we please find out what's causing cancer? And it's hard to do, but you know, it makes sense to put some money there.
So are you seeing a trend that way then? People acknowledging? I mean, because you've talked about how kind of archaic really mammographies can be. Even self-exams can be, you know, they tend to sort of, once you detect it, it's almost too late at some point. These are not really about prevention as much as they should be, I guess.
Right. By the time you find a tumor, you know, the cancer's already there.
Yeah.
It's really too late. Although I am heartened that there are some great technologies being worked on right now. There are a lot of biotech companies working on, for example, protein markers that a tumor puts out very early in its development, and hopefully someday we'll be able to detect those just in a simple blood test. So I think it's not too far down the road that we'll be able to go in for checkup and say, oh, wow, you have the tiniest tumor just starting. Let's get it out now before it spreads.
But what you're also saying is, and I think one of the messages seems to be that you're going to have to start getting some kind of regulation from the government's going to have to start getting involved in regulating these kinds of chemicals if there's going to be a big difference made.
Well, one thing that really shocked me in researching this book is how few chemicals in our marketplace have ever been tested for human health effects. I think we all assume someone's out there keeping an eye on the chemicals around, you know, in our food products or in our personal care products, and they're just not. So yes, I think that – and mothers can be a very strong group in advocating for better safety testing. I think we also need to just provide better incentives for companies to use safer chemicals that don't, for example, sit on our estrogen receptor. You know, why are we using those chemicals? Let's find some other ones.
Let me ask you finally, less than a minute here. Do you expect sort of a transition in the way people are thinking about all of this? I guess it's one of the things you're hoping for in terms of the book, right?
I do. You know, I think with breasts, it's challenging. You're certainly not going to change attitudes toward how men see breasts. And there's a lot to be celebrated in those attitudes. You know, I'm glad that men like breasts so much. But I do hope, too, that we can view them in a little bit more of their pendulous complexity.
Florence Williams. Her book is called Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History. Thank you very much for the time.
It's been a pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.